Welcome back to Bitcoin Study Sessions. Today we're covering part two of Our Tribal Future. In reading through this, the thing that hit me most was the emphasis on friendship and the importance of having those people that make you who you are. The five people you surround yourself with are what define you. When I post this episode, at the end of it, there's a line that I always put: share with friends and please consider us yours. We're all in this together. And as we build our tribe, first through camps, then into bands, and finally into the tribe of people that we will walk through life with and meet the challenges that come to face us, it really strikes me the importance of defining those friends and being intentional about the way that we have people in our lives. The author, David Sampson, discusses one of the dangers of ideology in that if we identify as a member of an ideology in something that we can't control, Republican, Democrat, MAGA, woke, Yankee fan, then what we're doing is we're robbing ourselves of the ability to have control over our own lives. And so as I read through this, I wrote down what it means to me to have an identity. And my identity as a brother, as a friend, as a son, as a band member. And I realized that being a Bitcoiner wasn't on that list anymore. I can't control it. Bitcoin's out of the box. It's going to be what it's going to be. But where can I make an impact in my community? And it's going to be through my tribe, through my camp, through my friends. And so I wanted to start by reading this very simple quote. In fact, friends are evolved to be irreplaceable. That's what makes them real friends. And the science to support this is only now coming to full fruition. We're learning about the importance of each other here. And there's nobody that I'd rather talk about this with than Mr. Grant Reichert.
Friend to all, enemy to none, beloved by dogs in the neighborhood world round. So as Lucas mentioned, Our Tribal Future, we did the first part last time. Thank you for that lovely introduction. We're going to get into the nature of friendship here, how to build good friendships, how to build camps beyond friendships, how to deal with our own tribal nature. The last discussion we have, we did the first part of this book, which was the science of tribalism, essentially. And then in this part, we're going to go into kind of the practice of tribalism, how to use our tribal instinct in a good way. So we'll do what we always do. We'll give like a short introduction and then Lucas and I will hash it out and we'll continue on in that manner. We'd like to make sure, kind of give you a bit of a summary of the reading because that's kind of our proof of work. That's, we invest a lot of time in reading these books. We want to tie our discussions to the matter in the books. We want to convey that to you, the dear listener, that what these books say is important and we need to attend to the words themselves. And so in the first discussion, I'll kind of give a big recap just so we can situate the second discussion as well. This whole book begins with the problem, who do we trust? The first evolutionary response to this question is genetics. You trust your family. You have this drive built into you to want to help out your blood kin. The second evolved response then, as Lucas mentioned, is friendship. This requires larger brains and a social nature. But then how do we scale beyond this small group? The brain has a limited channel capacity with up to about 150. That's Dunbar's number. We discussed that last time, being a sort of cap on our ability to remember, catalog a history of social reactions, interactions with a person in a way that makes us comfortable around them. We do that with about 150 people. To move past this Dunbar's number, then we evolve the capacity for symbolic manipulation, to emit symbols and read symbols. The tribe drive is that instinct to build bigger coalitions by reading and emitting symbols that signal trustworthiness, sort of like social passwords, secret handshakes. We evolve to judge each other. We could, for example, suddenly be able to trust a stranger if they emit a symbol by making the sign of the cross. We could feel relaxed that we're now with a fellow Christian, a tribe bigger than 150, a tribe where we can't know everybody face to face. Yeah, we can still come to trust somebody. So we moved to the tribe as the biggest social unit, a group of groups. Samson in the first part described this kind of nesting structure, telescoping out with camps, the smallest nuclear unit, those with whom we find our calories and keep safe, maybe 20 to 30 adults in a hunter-gatherer camp. Bands then, a group of camps up to about the Dunbar's number of 150, which allow for genetic diversity so that these camp structures can proliferate over time. And then those bands nest into tribes, this imagined community beyond face-to-face, held together by symbols, linguistic, behavioral, gestural, ritualistic, that provide for group identity so that you can come to know and trust somebody who you do not know face-to-face. We call that tribalism. Usually it has bad connotations. Sometimes it does, rather. But it helped us to scale trustworthiness beyond face-to-face, and in any case, it is an evolved genetic drive, a tribe drive, that is a basic constitutive fact of our human nature, so you can't just condemn or ignore it. It would be like condemning being hungry or something like that. It's simply a drive we have. So in part two, Lucas and I are going to discuss today is called the practice of tribalism. It now continues applying this evolutionary anthropology lens to understand how our evolved instinctual tribe drive can be used to help us build better communities, better social relations, better friendships, something referred to by Samson as camp crafting, how to consciously, intentionally craft a camp. So before moving to that, though, Lucas, I mean, that was our kind of first discussion summarized. Anything just to recap that conversation you'd want to add or continue forward?
No, he does a good job of basically giving us the background of the science behind it, how we evolved into this camp to band to tribe. And now we're going to walk through some more things that are going to help us implement this, that yeah. are going to help us make this actionable and operational within our lives. Part two is if you think about like a movie, you've got the first one and then the sequel comes out. We've had this discussion that the sequels are rarely as good as the first one. Part two is utterly phenomenal, I think. I really enjoyed, he takes us through all kinds of different things. We finally talk about Bitcoin. We talk about Balaji's network state. We talk about the examples that exist in the world today that have been around for decades of co-living and cohabitation, co-location, I think is the term he uses. So
yeah,
no, he did a phenomenal job with it. And
Lucas is a subject matter expert on camp crafting, having been at the network state. So we're also going to dig into that. So Samson kind of begins this. In case you aren't convinced that community is even a good idea, Samson begins by making the case that we should seek greater social connectivity and more communal ways of living. Some people's suggestion is going to be just kind of duh, right? It's good to have good social relations, right? It's good to be in good community. But actually, in the United States, we do have the ideal of the rugged individualist, the person who lives a life of absolute independence, the sovereign individual. And even more practically in the United States, we tend to want single nuclear family dwellings, which are prone to what Samson calls dyadic withdrawal or cocooning, which is when you have a married or an established couple that then begins to seek the majority of their social interactions with each other and kind of fall out of a larger social network. They cocoon wife and husband, and they seek, again, social fulfillment in doing things together and kind of lose friends. And even within this, the men tend to have a more precipitously declining social network because of the nature of relationships that men and women tend to have. And Samson kind of frames this in a nice way. Men tend to have shoulder-to-shoulder relationships, which are activity-based, and females tend to have face-to-face or disclosure-based relationships. And so those types of activity-based relationships that tend to form the core of male relationships after initial periods of our life where we have like team sports and things like that, it gets harder to carve out the time, or so it seems, to do these activities to build shoulder to shoulder, typically male activity-based relationships. We can also now just buy the benefits of camps. You can, allo parenting is one of the benefits where you have other adults around to help look after your children and you look after theirs. Instead, people can just pay a nanny or drop their kids off at a daycare. Therapists can come to replace close kith and kin, friends and family, for those types of close conversations that one might have otherwise had with close social friends. So Samson goes into depth. I won't kind of go into all the research here, but he does describe the benefits of living in what he calls inintentional proximity with others. So in summary, the benefits are things like improved psychological well-being. That's not hard to imagine. We all know what social isolation feels like. Protection from the negative effects of dyadic withdrawal, which is, again, when couples withdraw into each other rather than having wider social networks. Improving conditions for family and children to grow with cooperative alloparenting. That's another benefit of living in intentional proximity. Improved quality of life while consuming less resources. If you have more people paying the same rent, you have more resources to use on other things. And then, of course, increased access to human and social capital. As you have wider social networks, you know somebody who's a butcher or someone who's a baker, and you can reach out to them. Somebody who knows how to fix the engine that breaks down when you don't know how to fix the engine. So just to pause right there, are there any, do these seem like reasonable benefits of living in close intentional proximity? And are there others, I guess, or other reasons why people should be concerned with the way that we live now and want to consciously try to live in intentional proximity?
Yeah, I think we need to really focus on the framing of why this is important. You did mention that, you know, we all know what social isolation feels like, but to me, when I read through that, it was a bit of a revelation to me, because that social isolation that we feel is a bit of a boiling the frog type of thing, where we are living in it right now, and most of us have this break in our memory that began in 2020, and it's kind of the past is the past, and then whatever the world that we're living in now has taken over. And so when we think about social isolation, I'm really struggling with that S. When we think about that, It's hard to overstate the importance of the situation that we are living in right now, where social isolation is the norm, and we've been conditioned to it. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, you and I and a lot of other people are coming to the realization now is that sleep is the most important part of your health. And I remember when I first got a good night of sleep as an adult. It was, you know, about 6 years ago. I had completely forgotten what it felt like to feel good in the morning, even though, you know, I wasn't doing anything that was crazy or whatever, but, you know, like a lot of other people, I was watching Netflix to fall asleep and had the lights on and wasn't getting up with the sun, wasn't getting early morning sun in my eyes, wasn't getting the sun at night. And it's a revelation, because you remember something that you had completely forgotten. You remember what it feels like to be ready to engage with the world. That's social isolation. It's not just something that we should accept, because it's not natural. There's a much better life. And I would almost liken it to like escaping some sort of addiction.
Yeah.
Because the power of engaging with a community, of having that knowledge that you have people around you that are supportive and are going to be there for you.
Yeah.
There's so many people that they just don't have people.
Right.
So, and that leads into another thing that you mentioned, which is that danger of cocooning, which is something that with the best of intentions, we have heralded and celebrated, you know, the good father who goes home to his wife and kids, right, and doesn't go play poker, doesn't go golf, doesn't, you know, engage with a group of male friends, so that we have started to look at those people, those men and women who they get married and they effectively remove themselves from society and they lean upon each other for everything. Samson does a great job of going into not only the kind of the first principles idea of it, but also the reality of it, is that if you forge with someone, if you're fused together, then there's no longer a connection. If I'm so close to someone that they are my everything, that they are my heartbeat, they are literally everything to me, then we no longer have a connection because we truly are one. I think when I read that, I thought about welding and just fusing two pieces of metal together. And when you do that, it's no longer flexible.
Yeah.
Right? It can no longer bend. It can no longer adjust. It can no longer have any give. And so that when we exclude all of those things from our lives, as men, when we exclude our group of friends, as women, when we exclude our group of friends, then we're no longer able to connect with our spouse or our partner because we have fused with them. And we talked about this last night, that there needs to be that mystique, that you have to have something interesting about that person, yeah, that you still want to find out. You always want to be continuously learning about this person and never feel like you've reached the end, because then the book is done and
yeah,
you want to move on to another book. And,
yep,
and it may sound counterintuitive, but this idea that being with one person and making them your everything is laudable is actually the cause of a lot of fractured relationships and poor parenting and poor childhoods and poor marriages.
Yeah. No, Samson refers to it. That is the paradox of intimacy, that you do have to, as much as you want to know every contour and aspect of a person, there needs to be some mystery of them to make you want to continue to learn and know about them, but to have something to learn and know about them. It was interesting that you began your remarks noting kind of the analogy to sleep, how it was a revelation to suddenly have a good night's sleep, in the same way that when you come out of social isolation, it can also be a personal revelation as to well-being. Samson, he, in his other research as an evolutionary anthropologist, talks about the nature of beginning in our early ancestors, whatever ape, slept in trees, and then we became ground sleepers after that. And when you become ground sleepers, there are certain dangers you have to attend to, that when you're a tree sleeper, you're kind of safer in your branch or whatever. Yeah. When you're ground sleepers, we then have to become more social. We have to look out for each other. And so that the nature of sleep is also part of this evolutionary history that makes us more social and that brings us together and inculcates in us this tribe drive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The just another thing about that was the research into the social. I'm going to say loneliness because I'm struggling with it.
Yeah.
But loneliness literally has a genetic effect on your body, in
yeah,
that your genes no longer express characteristics that make you that raise your immune system and protect you from illness, and they protect you from actual physical maladies,
yeah,
that you're going to suffer from when you're alone.
Yeah. No, and you said an addiction, there is a social craving you have when you're in isolation. And as we're going to see later on here, there are surrogate forms of community, tribes that are going to latch onto that, make people, you want a sense of belonging, join our larger tribe, our political tribe, our religious tribe, our cult, whatever.
Instant acceptance.
Yeah, right? You're going to get that craving to be in intentional proximity with other people satisfied one way or another. So there are healthy ways to do it. So those are the kind of benefits of being in intentional proximity with others and the dangers of withdrawing from that, falling out of intentional proximity, of social isolation. So then what is it that makes a camp or a group survive? If we want to form these bigger coalitions, these bigger groups, what are the parameters of that? So we are humans. We've evolved as specific types of animals, social, symbol-using apes. There is a specific, like, you know, state space of possible social relations. There's not just, we can imagine an infinite number of types of camps, of bizarre rituals, behaviors, and customs, but only a finite range of those are actually things we can put into place, just given the types of beings that we are and our behaviors. Samson calls this the social suite. Any group that you form is going to have to satisfy certain dynamics. And these are things like basic things like love, friends, social networks, cooperation, but also things, a couple of interesting ones, in-group bias, things that pull the group together, a mild hierarchy, even he says individual identity. Being in a group is not, and this is kind of, again, that paradox of intimacy. It's not about completely losing your individuality, but about everybody having their individual identity so that they can form some relationship with other people in the groups.
Can I read the quote?
If you got a quote, read it.
The quote is that, the more we depend on each other, the closer we come to independence. More effectively dependent people, the more effectively you are dependent upon the people around you, the more independent and daring you are with the world. So it is this paradox of the tighter you have this group around you, and the more that you depend on other people around you to be that person that is going to raise you up when you fall, the more free you are in order to become your true self and express your, you know, chase your dreams and follow what you want to do in the world.
Yes. And so he calls that the dependency paradox, and why it's important to specifically build strong camps and honor groups, tight groups of friends before you develop or seek like an intimate relationship with a pair bond, with a male or female who's going to be your spouse, because you want to not be totally dependent on another person. You want to like form this reservoir of confidence before you stride out into the world. That the individual identity that is part of the social suite that defines the state space of potential groups is also just like about the potential to reciprocally engage with other people, just even as basic as that, just even to have something to like give and to be able to receive something from a group, you have to be something separate and apart from it. Before we look at larger groups, Samson does, he focuses on like smaller combinations. And like I just mentioned those, so I want to get into that. One of the first is the honor group. That's like a small group of close friends bound by honor. You consider this like a chosen, or he says a forged family. This group, and we're just kind of talking about this, should precede, in a sense, your dyadic pair bond that you form with a wife, a husband. Once you have that honor group in place, you will relate better to a potential spouse and to the world because you have certain basic needs on Maslow's hierarchy of needs satisfied. And so you can self-actualize in relation to others, rather than like going out into the world existentially vulnerable and seeking everything, falling on the knee to the first girl or guy you see and declaring your love because you just need it so bad, you know?
Well, and that the importance of that honor group, this is when I read this, I think like these are in your mind, these are the people that you call to hide the body. Like if the worst thing happens, mm-hmm. it's like, who are the five people that I can call and be like, oh, shit just went really bad.
Yeah.
You know,
and all on hiding the body, the third part of the Pusher trilogy, hiding the body is not a trivial ordeal. It's a very messy thing. Continue though.
Remember, we should all, you've been here, you've heard me talk about this many times on stage. We should all have a murder plan. Yeah. You shouldn't plan on the murder, but if it happens, then you should always have a plan to dispose of the body. So make sure that you develop that. But the importance of that, developing that honor group is that without those people around you, then you have not yet outwardly defined your moral existence. And by having that honor group, you're able to navigate what is the personal morality by which I want to live in the world. And then you can have that as a baseline to go find a mate. You said this very well, you know, that if you don't have that, in the absence of that, then you will fall prey to finding someone who purports to, or who you project upon, your need to fulfill everything.
Yeah.
And that's a fail. Like, no one can be everything to one person. This was my bros before hoes note, where you, as a woman, you need to have these friends that are your support group that help you know what is the line and who am I? And as men, it's also incredibly important. Because otherwise, then you just wander out into the world alone with someone else who is alone. And two lonely people are just going to fuse together and be aimlessly floating in a sea of trouble, you know? So, yeah, it's tough. But yeah, date after you have a defined honor group, because you are going to remove yourself somewhat from that group when you have that person. And so you need to have a solid understanding of who you are as an individual and what are the morals that you value.
Right. And not just dating. I mean, that's one application it's very helpful in that, but just even to be a strong, independent individual in the world, to know the profession that you want to enter into, to be able to help others in the community, you need to be, you know, have your basic needs satisfied. And one of those is company, is being with others. And so that honor group helps in so many ways. So then how do we forge this honor group? And then here we begin to get into earnest this idea of camp crafting, which is a lot of what the second part of this book is about. So to quote Samson, in essence, humans are wired in a way that makes a group experiencing adversity stronger and mentally more resilient, where the adversity itself is recollected with fondness and nostalgia. I read that to introduce the first way that we camp craft, which is adversity. There's many ways. We'll go through a few here. I'm going to say adversity is the first. So therefore, if you want to create stronger bonds, do challenging things together with the people who you want to be in an honor group with. To find new friends, seek out experiences that simulate adversity or that maybe are actually adverse. He mentions Samson does hot yoga, martial arts, or even tabletop role playing, like a literal simulation of adversity and seeing how other people team together in that role playing simulation to deal with the situations that you're all communally as a team confronting. In addition to adversity, Samson notes that there are maybe a simpler way, or an accompanying way rather, is to create rituals of a different sort that can forge an honor group. There can be, for example, time-based rituals, as something as simple as every week on Wednesday evening, we're going to go to the same restaurant and get a meal, all of us together. We're going to hold that time sacred. We're all going to be sure to be there, and we're going to do that. Or maybe an annual one where we're all going to do a retreat, a vacation together, a trip, a hike. And it's going to be something where you have to pool resources, plan it out, again, hold it sacred, that time, keep it that it is something you're going to do. There's also specific types of consecration rituals. You've heard about being a blood brother, maybe getting a tattoo, things like that. You consecrate this new bond that you forge with somebody by something to mark that in a very ritualistic way. So those are a couple: adversity, ritual, I'll pause there. Those are kind of camp crafting on the friendship level. I mean, would you have anything to add to that as far as like how to build those bonds?
Just experiences. 2 months in to my stay at the network school, there was this period. We kind of entered a lull. You know, everybody.
So you're going to be talking about the network school. Maybe just like define what it is just a bit.
Yeah. Okay. So Balaji Srinivasan, the idea that we have moved past the foundational structure of a nation state into what are called network states, that the church was the source of information for everybody, And then the printing press came along and we could all get information. And that democratized information a little bit, but it got re-centralized because power always moved to a single source in order for protection. So then nation states arose, which is the world that we ostensibly live in today. United States, Russia, China, El Salvador, Suriname, these are nation states. But the internet has further democratized information to the point that you are the media. We're a perfect example of this. We are the media now, and we are the source of information by which everyone can individually check against their own life experience to move themselves closer to the truth. And so the organizational structure of society in Balaji's thesis is that we move from the church state to the nation state to the network state. And Balaji is building this in public with the network school, which is currently about 150 to 200 people from all across the entire world who are techno-optimists, who believe that they can come together, that they have met in the cloud, and now they are on land together building a community that will give them basically a values-based system with which to navigate the world.
Yes. So you were at the network state then, and then what did you learn then about this?
So I was just having this memory of like I said, about 2 months in, you know, the newness and the novelty had worn off a little bit for people, and we'd kind of entered maybe a little bit of a lull. And I remember that there was a group that started a Dungeons and Dragons get together. And there's this fella named Tim Trutna who's there, who is like the most interesting man in the world. As he says, once you've completed the main quest, it's just side quests all the way out. And he became a dungeon master. And I watched it in the matter of days go from, oh, there's six nerds in this group, to now they're meeting off site and there's 20 people, and they're spending hours a day planning and crafting, and there's pizza and there's beer or whatever. They're going to get together. And it really became a cohesive thing that brought people together.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic what it did for the group morale. And so that's that's an example of building through ritual.
Yeah. And then, that's because Dungeons and Dragons is all about creating an imagined community. Yep. So it's just so directly a type of campcraft. It's very interesting.
Yep. And I had the other example of when you and I first reconnected after 15 years not really having, I think, seen each other. One of the things that I had mentioned to you was I'd read this guy, he had this great idea, not his idea, but it's this Japanese term called, I think it's a masogi, which is like every month you do something difficult that takes you out of your comfort zone. And I had mentioned that to you. And we decided that we would start cold plunging in the Columbia River at 4:30 in the morning, in the dark, ice floating by, river otters crawling by, homeless guys in the bushes, you know. And it started with you and I, right? And it certainly was kind of terrible. Like, you're out there, it's completely dark.
Yeah.
There's sounds that you don't know. You're utterly free. We had literally no clue what we were doing. We left it up to me to determine how long we were going to stay in the water. If you're cold plunging anything more than 3 minutes, you're just working on your brain. We just arbitrarily was like, oh, 15 minutes seems like a good time to start with. And so we're just dying out there. But it started with you and I. And within a month, we had 10 to 12, 15 people. There was a story written about it in the newspaper. And through that, we built this group that was super tight and really leaned upon each other because we braved that together. And it was incredibly difficult.
Yes.
And it really built those bonds between people. So real life examples of those things, yoga and the working out together, just go camping and do something that takes you away from the creature comforts, that you otherwise, without doing that, you can't appreciate the abundance that you have around you.
Yeah. Adversity, I mean, another word is suffering. And Samson, I don't know if it's his coinage or if it's another thesis somebody else has, it's the community of sufferers idea that when you're with other people and you're suffering together, you build strong bonds. And we saw this after 9/11, people that went through that together. There was this like nationwide pause mass shootings. Yep. and like there was a lot less suicide around the nation. People came together. We experienced this moment of communal adversity, maybe literal suffering for many people. And yeah, that it brought us together. And like Lucas said, we can stimulate that. If there's a cold river, go jump in it. If there's, you know, plan this out with some friends, do it together. And it is something that builds bonds. So that's kind of adversity, rituals. These are some ways that with individuals, you can kind of begin to forge these bonds. And Samson continues to move more in earnest into this whole camp crafting science. What Samson wants to give us in part two is a scientifically grounded guide on how to create an ancestral home, a space with capacity to transcend generations and bring people you most care about together. So it's not just, it's very important about friendship, but it is about building this idea of a home, a place where you can have communal and generational contact with people. More succinctly, camp crafting then is this act of building intentional community. Camp crafting, unsurprisingly, is about the camp, which is an honor group situated in its environment. There's different sizes, estimates he kind of gives at different points, maybe up to about 50 people. You don't all have to be friends, but there has to be transitivity where everybody's a friend of a friend, essentially. And there's a high degree of like, okay, I'm not, you know, the best friends with Kevin, but Kevin is friends with Alan, and Alan's my best friend or whatever. So there's that high transitivity where you're all connected like that. In camp crafting, that group cohesion is incredibly important. It stems from having not just that transitivity, but a strong group purpose and a shared identity. Some ways that this can be done: define and ritualize membership and onboarding process and initiation ceremony, something that demarcates entry and makes people feel that they've entered and belong to something. Create a space for personal, meaningful communication, rich psychological safety. Consistent meeting times where people can bring and plan projects and related activities together without judgment, without bad judgment in any case. Enhance similarity in the context of diversity. You can have shared like t-shirts, rituals. Everybody can have their own nickname that's individual to them, but you all have nicknames. He also notes that as a source for these types of things, you can draw from religion, existing ones, past religions, create ritual without religious context. And that's why, you know, your emphasis on Dungeons and Dragons there, or mentioning that's very interesting, because within Dungeons and Dragons, in a situation like that, you're focusing on fantasy and you're often drawing from the history of like the medieval ages or some specific era that was very rich in rituals and religious types of symbols. And you're creating a literal form of imagined community. So one last note on this, perhaps even more important than maybe ritual or adversity, four camps, and you mentioned this in the introduction, Lucas, is co-location, living next to or near those who will be in your honor group. It can take many forms: buying houses in the same neighborhood, pooling together to buy a house, communally constructing a new house or compound together, giving consideration for people having their own personal space while also preserving a shared communal space. And then considering things like urban versus rural, which often comes down to not one is bad or good, but access to culture, which is often in the urban setting, or access to cheap space, which is often in the rural setting. So those are some: ritual, adversity, co-location, creating rituals, membership, enhancing similarity to the context of diversity. Those are some ways of camp crafting. I guess, is there anything? And he gives a lot of other ones. He looks at the big five social, like psychological characteristics, how those fit in. He even gives an evolutionary account of group governance. But what do you think? Is there anything, I guess, you would add to those aspects of camp crafting as a science? Or do you think that those are good considerations?
I think they're natural. When I read the book, what I'm doing is I'm thinking about how does this relate to the life that I've lived and what I've experienced. And the hazing is, you know, it's had such a negative connotation. But hazing is really important. A group initiation is initiation of an individual to a group is a better way to say it. But it's important to distinguish yourself as you join a group because it lets everyone else know, you know, look, we suffered to get here and you're going to suffer just a little bit. But once you've have, then you're in. And you just think about the importance of that and having that community of sufferers. I had a football coach who actually explained to me one time, we all hated the guy. and he explained one time that it's really important to give everybody a common enemy.
Yeah.
Because then they can bond together. And once they bond together, then all of a sudden he moves in and he flipped from being the enemy to being, okay, now you guys have forged yourself as a team. And here I am to be the person that will be a guide for you. But you have to go through this together. You have to experience what it's like to suffer individually.
Interesting.
And then the nicknames, like,
yeah,
you know, I love having nicknames for people. When I was teaching in man camp, when we were in the band, when you're on the baseball team, you know, that's how you know that you have something. It is that secret handshake,
yeah,
but verbally said, that signifies that you're part of a group. And yeah, it's just really important, you know? So, I guess the lesson is, you know, haze each other, give each other nicknames, you know, create these rituals.
Yeah. Were any of these types of things present at the network state? Was there an onboarding process that reinforced the solemnity of the identity of the group that you were joining, if you recall, or like any sort of shared t-shirt ritual nickname or some sort of shared, yeah, like a thing that gave a person an identity individual to them, but also as a part of a group, any of these things?
So I think that the number of people there, which is, you know, like 150 to 200, that kind of exceeds that camp size. And so maybe, you know, we all have this initiation where we come in and it's chaos for the first couple of days where you're trying to find where the gym is and get into your schedule, and then Balaji speaks and give his overall vision. But then within that, the camps start defining okay, themselves, yeah, you know? And so I think like that was probably a reason why Man Camp was such a success, was because...
What was Man Camp?
So Man Camp was an evolution of me fixing stuff. I was there and there was a cold plunge, but it hadn't been put together yet. And so I wanted to use a cold plunge. So I put it together, and then we got a sauna and it came in pallets and 4,000 pieces. And I recruited four Indian dudes that had never swung a hammer and didn't know that there was more than one type of screwdriver to help me put it together. And they came, Donovan, who's the co-founder, and Jackson, who's the founding director, came to me and said, hey, this is actually really useful. A lot of the people that are here did not grow up in an environment where they needed to have these practical skills. Most of the people there were from bigger cities and oftentimes from cultures where labor is so cheap that it just makes more sense to pay someone else to do all that stuff for you. But the joy that these guys had and the girls, by the way, that they had in participating in this was such that it raised the morale. There was a lot of excitement about it. And so they came to me and they said, hey, would you be interested in creating a curriculum around this? And so we created Man Camp, which is, you know, we had a course on tying knots. We had a Shop Olympics where we took, I'll never forget my friend Juba, who went from, it took him 8 minutes to saw through a board. The first time that I gave him a handsaw, and the next day he was doing it in 45 seconds.
Yeah.
And there was just so much appreciation and accomplishment. Another time I remember handing a guy a power drill and thinking, oh, I'm just going to teach this guy the the fine intricacy of using a power drill, you know, to be able to keep the torque proper and keep it straight. And I gave it to him, and the first thing he did was try to hammer a screw in with the power drill. It's like, oh, okay, we got to start. We're not starting at zero. We're starting at like -5. But it was difficult for these guys. We did another one where I taught him how to rope. And you had Matt Berman was this kid from England who stayed an extra 2 hours the first time and had never been able to even rope something 3 feet in front of him until he was able to consistently do it. And in learning what we taught, because they built their own lariats, in learning that, he took that knowledge and he used it to build his own community, which was a badminton group. By knowing how to tie these knots that we taught, and he applied that, and he said, oh, I can go into the gym and I can clear away the space where we do our workouts, and I can string up a badminton net temporarily. And then all of a sudden we had 45 people playing badminton.
It had such a
huge effect on that.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
It's interesting because I began asking you, like, does the network state have these types of things that characterize camp crafting? Yeah. But also, like, you make a really good point. Like, the network state is 150 or above. It's like hitting Dunbar's number. You can be comfortable with the people at the network state, but maybe you don't have that personal relationship. Yeah. A tribe or groups is like nested groups of groups. Within that, camps begin to arise, man camp literally, and then you have these moments of adversity. We need to learn a skill to take care of a problem, and then you do it together communally. And then there's the D&D camp, and then there's the badminton camp. So these camps are nested within a bigger identity, which is the network state. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's interesting that that's how the network state is kind of, it's this bigger identity, and all these camps then on which you have the face-to-face relationship kind of emerge within that.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and they said when you show up, you know, Balaji is going to be very upfront. Like, this is frontier. It's not fancy. We're going to learn through adversity. And I wanted to give one more example because this one I think was the one that really, really brought us together. Was 3 weeks in. So the first week I was just figuring stuff out, but I went and bought myself a guitar on the second day. And 2 weeks in, I was like, if I don't play music, I'm going to lose my mind. And so I hosted a concert. It was awesome. It was a big success. We had all these people. And the first thing I did was like, I don't want to do this alone. I don't want to own this. I went to my friend Leo, who is a guy with 2 PhDs in philosophy that dresses in a cape and walks around and reads tarot cards to people. But he also makes fine Italian food. And so he started La Dolce Vita, which was this little pop-up kitchen. And then we had other people, Manasa and Adam, these guys, these people that came in and they helped with setup, and they helped. We had five people acting as waiters and waitresses in order to serve everybody that were just volunteering, and they were coming together. And the third week, the air conditioning went out, and you know, this is in Malaysia; it's very hot. And we're up on the 11th floor. The air conditioning had been out for a couple of days, and we're in this room, and it is pushing 90 degrees Fahrenheit. People are sweating, and they're just, it was miserable in there. But we decided not to cancel it. We went ahead and we pushed through, and we had this like great bonding experience that I still, to this day, and so do the people that were there, they still remember that, because that was when we defined a theme song.
Yeah.
Kind of for the, which was a, there was a, there was an instance, we had a lost and found box to put the stuff that people left laying around. And we showed up that day and the stuff was there and somebody had stolen the damn lost and found box. And I have a song called Lost and Found. And so we reflected on the hilarity of that. And that became kind of our theme. It really bonded us together and really brought us together. We're up there sweating like crazy, but gathering together to rejoice in fellowship and play music.
Yeah, and I'm glad you give all that context about regarding what the network state is about. We read and discussed Balaji's online hyperlinked series of essays that is kind of the network state book, which is kind of an evolving sort of book. One of the things that struck me throughout the discussion, very interesting intellectual thesis, but there was like a sterility to it of like, a nation for me was not just a set of people together, but it was about this almost unchosen set of bonds that you have with a group of people. And so to hear you talk about the emergent camps within the network state, it fills out Balaji's thesis in a critical way, I think. You can talk abstractly about community, but when you see, oh, community can arise when people place themselves in intentional proximity, they can consciously create it. And, you know, they're probably going to create it because that instinct, we have this tribe drive, people are going to want to build the groups that they're a part of. There's a really good quote here. Samson is talking about kind of the role, I believe he's talking about the role of like shamans, shamanic figures in helping to craft the identity of a group. And he notes, this is kind of from our evolutionary history, we literally survived and thrived as a species because some leaders of our past told good stories about what made us special. So it's that feeling of becoming special by sharing in a story with others that people who are leaders have taken the time to either consciously or unconsciously tell a story about what we're all doing here together. And then you have, you're infused with a shared purpose and a shared identity. I just wanted to note that. It's really cool. I hope you keep on talking about that and that this network state idea is kind of enriched with the actual community that's involved in it and not just an intellectual thesis.
Yeah, like a country, a nation, to me, it's three things. It is borders, because without that, then you don't have, you know, this geographically defined area. It's property rights, because without that, then you can't prosper. But then the third thing, it's that narrative. It's that we are collectively going to agree to the same basic story. Because without that, then we don't have this inherent trust with each other. We don't have this inherent similarity and the bond that comes from living in the same, living in the same movie, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You know? That same shared story that makes us special, the same movie.
There's another, I wanted to get, I know I'm giving a lot of examples, but there, I did want to give a shout out to Sam, who runs the gym there, came up with a boot camp, it's just like, it was a more aggressive workout program for people who really wanted to make a physical transformation. And that group, you know, these are guys that, and girls, that came in, a lot of them had never lifted weights before. Many of them had never really, these are keyboard warriors by and large. There are some phenomenal athletes there, but by and large, they were keyboard warriors coming in and coming together at the same time every day in order to work out and having the group chat where people are sharing their progress. And when they go off campus, they're sending back proof of workout. You know, they're showing, hey, look, I'm still with you. I found a gym, or I went outside and I did my workout there. And that group got really tight as well too.
Yeah. And so this, these examples are all great. And I hope someone listening can, maybe they come to understand Samson's thesis. Another sense, maybe they see what the network state is about. But in a third, very real sense, we can take whatever community you're in, we can begin to camp craft within our local community. We can get some workout partners together. We can do a practical skills course. None of that is impossible. You don't have to go to the network state to do that. These are all just fantastic ideas, because I think we do all find ourselves in our modern, as you know, as Samson mentions and describes, in a suburban society of single nuclear families where we begin to lose the community that if we don't consciously create, we're never going to have. So those are some of that's camp crafting in a nutshell. There's a lot of stuff we kind of left out of the discussion by necessity. We kind of saw the good part of community. In the last two chapters, Samson describes how the tribe drive, though, can be bad, and then how we can address the badness of the tribe drive by kind of bootstrapping the tribe drive itself to move beyond tribalism to a meta-tribal era. So to continue kind of summarizing the book, recall that tribalism arises as a solution to this need to, how do we know who to trust? We evolve first genetic kinship. We trust the people we're related to. Then friendship. We trust the people in face-to-face relationships. And then we develop, we evolve the tribe drive, this ability to believe, to trust people who believe the same symbolic stuff that you do, participate in the same larger stories. So we move from the kinship era to the friendship era to the tribal era. And that's where we're at right now. We are still living in a tribal era. In this tribal era, we have tended to become more and more centralized and authoritarian to kind of coerce and control and enforce cooperation among members of different coalitions, different groups within the larger tribal identity. To quote Samson, the chains of centralization with elite autocrats and tyrants commanding bureaucratic thralls that hold the keys to our shackles has been a favored stratagem. Around 4 billion humans currently live under authoritarian regimes. And alongside that, we just got finished reading the Satoshi Papers. And in the introduction to that, we learned about how the U.S. founding, our Republican project, was an ad hoc system of kind of checks and balances to rein in authority and give individuals living within, who wanted to start a new project together, under the values of democracy, the Enlightenment values, free markets, freedom of association, as kind of a reaction to that authoritarian way that groups are held together, and how we kind of need now a refounding given the authoritarian drift and centralizing drift of the last 250 years. That's kind of the general picture in any case. Things can look even bleaker for us when we think about what it means that we are in a tribal area, that we're all still essentially tribal. On one hand, we have the evils of in-group tribalism, us versus them, in-group versus out-group, racism, genocide. On the other hand, to combat that, the evil of increasing centralization, authoritarianism to deal with our tribal impulses, the increasing attempts to dismantle our private associations and ignore our very real genetic impulse to care more for those closest to us than we care for strangers. And I kind of describe that as evil in-group tribalism, evil centralization, and saying evil. But one of Samson's key points is that the tribe drive and tribalism really is not an ethical crisis, it's an energy crisis. And what he means by that is that it's cognitively difficult, energetically costly, to think equally of everybody, to think of everyone as friend and family, because we evolved to have a channel capacity mentally to see a certain subset of people as irreplaceable, as valuable. Despite what people say, you really can't love everybody equally. It's kind of a good, you know, abstract notion to consider, but we don't literally have the brain capacity to do that. We don't have the energy to process that number of social relations. We have limited bandwidth for empathy and a larger but more energy-intensive set of mental processes that allow us to deal with people who we don't have that empathic bond with strangers. So Samson then suggests a new moral framework to deal with this tribalism that we still have in the tribal era we're in which we can still embrace the good parts of tribalism to a degree while curtailing its negative aspects. And he calls this view the concentric circle. So in this view, this moral theory, we can imagine an inner circle with our honor group, and then greater circles around that kind of proceeding outward with more and more people added up to like Dunbar's number, the number of people we can process and be comfortable around, then expanding beyond that. Those are the concentric circles. So the moral principle behind this theory is essentially that it's okay to privilege that inner circle, your in-group, as long as you don't cause the outer circle pain or harm them. So it's kind of like a negative liberty conception where the freedom to swing my fist stops at my neighbor's nose. You can privilege your in-group, but you can't do so in a way that harms the out-group. It's not necessarily problematic to privilege the in-group. It's actually very important. We should be allowed to love friends and family more than we love, you know, some stranger we've never met. And if we focus on our individual health before helping others, then focus on our in-group before other groups, we tend to build a stronger world because we're focusing on communities where we can move the needle a bit and actually influence and impact things. So again, on this view, as long as you don't cause pain or loss of human thriving to an out-group, you can continue to operate with your in-group and shower, you know, your attention and gifts upon them. So I guess, what do you think about this, either the framing of ourselves living in a tribal era or Samson's response that we should reframe our morality as a sort of concentric circle, privileging an inner circle, but not harming the outer circle?
the beginning of having good relationships with other people is having a good relationship with yourself. And self-care and self-love is a caring act for other people. Because when you take care of your body, when you take care of your mind, when you take care of your responsibilities and focus on your spirituality and your ability to navigate the world with confidence, you're building yourself up, but what you're also doing is making yourself less of a burden to other people. If I'm healthy and in good shape, then I can come help you move. The converse of that is if I eat myself into a wheelchair, then I'm now a burden on the people around me. And so self-care is a loving act for other people. And that concentric circle starts individually with the person and then expands to the honor group and then to the sympathy group and then to Dunbar's number, to that tribe. I love the thought example that Samson gives, which is the sympathy group is the dozen or so people who, if they were to pass, you would be crushed, and it would truly wreck you emotionally. And he says, well, you know, I think it's like 180,000 or however many people die every single day. And imagine trying to live in a world where you had the same, like if you were to pass away, and that would just wreck, like imagine if I felt that 180,000 times a day, every single day, I wouldn't be able to navigate the world. And so he does a good job of framing to us why you can't love everyone equally.
Yeah.
And why it's important to prioritize your in-group, your close concentric circles, as long as you're not, and that's the litmus test, is as long as you're not hurting those other people around you.
Yeah.
It's just, self-care is a loving act is the thing that I start, like I think that it's important to take it all the way down to the atomic level of, you don't start with your honor group, you start with yourself. And a lot of times you need that honor group to help you find yourself, and help you keep moving morally in the direction that you want to go. You know, it's moral to be physically fit. It's moral to be educated. It's moral to, go to bed and get up early, in order to be the best person you can be for the people around you, because the more you can do that, the more you can elevate the group and build concentrically around. I had a question for you, because he talks about I believe it's the Meta tribe, and he gives the example of the conquerors of the past.
Yeah.
What they did was they completely erased any sort of like tribal, you know, we're going to take your gods, your statues, and we're going to take them away. We're going to kill the entire line of your royalty. And we're just literally going to wipe away any sort of tie that you have to the people that you were before we conquered you, in order to effectively force you to integrate into what we have. And success was finally found when the approach became that we're going to allow for that to be part of the story. And not a fracture of the story, but literally like, look, this was part of the fate. Part of the fate of your story was to become part of our story, and that we're going to build. And so what it makes me think of is like back at the network state, you know, there's people from 120 different countries there. And I'd love to ask, and maybe we'll get the chance to talk to Balaji someday about this, but I'm curious about, is it necessary to leave behind your previous identity as an American, as an Indian, as a Japanese or Chinese? Is it necessary for us as we move into this era of network states to leave that identity behind and to identify as a network state, you know, primarily.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
On the first part, that's very interesting. That is a story that Samson relates in his book about how Cyrus the Great in the past invented a new mode of empire creating. Before, it was, as he said, symbolic genocide was the way that conquerors did it. They came in, rolled through, destroyed all customs, local gods, and everything. Cyrus the Great had a new mode of empire building where he let people keep the local gods, but they essentially had to recognize him as kind of a meta god over them. He integrated them into a new symbolic structure while allowing them to keep their old one. And that's a lot easier to do because, as Samson notes, identities are very sticky. You try to do a symbolic genocide, but you really can't root out from the human heart all of those associations that people have. You know, people will die for their god and they'll continue to believe in their god even if the representations are destroyed. As to whether we can integrate our own identities into some new notion of a network state, one of the things about the network state, it's like the idea is society as a service, is a subscription model, is exit is the primary aspect of it, where if you don't like it, you can leave, marked against loyalty and voice, which are the other modes of operation where you can be loyal to something and not leave it and think you have to stay in and build the house that's burning down or whatever to repair it. And I think that there's some, how it felt to me when we were discussing the network state is, there's some conflict there with being able to freely leave, being able to freely choose who you will associate with, and the notion of identity being unchosen, which is how I kind of deeply feel. We have a book up here by Alistair MacIntyre, kind of facing the camera. We have a lot of books by Alistair MacIntyre. I do. He's my favorite philosopher. And one of his quotes is, if you want to know what you should do in life, first ask yourself, what stories am I a part of? These are stories that you find yourself a part of. You don't create the story. The stories are already there. He critiques existentialist philosophy, saying, if you think that existence precedes essence, that you can freely choose every aspect of who you are, on what criteria will you choose? Do you choose the criteria that by which you're going to choose? There's an infinite regress if you think that every aspect of who you are can be freely chosen. There's a bedrock bottom foundational aspect of you that is unchosen. That's like you are born as a son. You are born as a member of the local religion, the local physical, spatial community. All of these things are unchosen. You can later go on in life to develop and elaborate the stories that those unchosen identities impart on you, but I don't think you can exit them. I think you'll always bring them with you. Maybe a network state can integrate those to a certain degree, but for me, exit has always seemed less important than loyalty or voice, than working within the narratives you find yourself a part of to help elaborate them is much more important than trying, and much for my own, in my own perspective, much better than trying to leave those stories and find new stories that are better. The things that you choose, you're always going to end up choosing based on criteria that in some sense were unchosen. And so just accept that. Accept that we have identities we don't choose and then work within those to realize fully the potential that you can have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The creation of no-fault divorce in the United States is what I'm thinking about right now, which is that's the exit. You know, previously you kind of had loyalty. I'm just going to suffer through whatever this relationship has become, or voice, which is, you know, that I'm going to try and assert my position and make things better. But adding exit to the institution of marriage seemed like a great idea at the time. But what we have observed since then, obviously skyrocketing divorce rates, but also people that generally speaking are less happy in their relationships, and they're less because they have the option of just leaving, then you don't have to put into it that type of investment that you do when you don't have that option.
Yeah.
That you can you can, there is a negative unintended consequence of exit, which is that you lack the forcing function of, I have to figure this out.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to sentence you to another year of hard marriage and then come back and see me. Maybe you guys figure it out. And some people did and some people didn't. But, you know, marriage as the institution is, as we have it in the Western society, is you made a vow before your family, your friends, and your God, that you're going to do this till you die. And then we put this loophole in that would just like, well, unless you decide not to. And I think that the consequence of that has probably been negative overall. Yeah. It's, you know, you don't want to force people to stay in something that's horrible, but it turns out that maybe giving them the option to just throw up their hands and exit, is not helping anybody.
Yeah. For sure. Another example, in the West, we have really developed this idea of autonomy, your ability to choose freely every aspect of your being. You're allowed to exit everything up into including your gender. But the question is, even if you find these institutions oppressive that you find yourself a part of, being born in a gender that you don't feel identified with, another way to respond to that is to say, I'm not going to exit. I'm going to continue to elaborate the institution I find myself a part of. Institutions grow, change organically comes from within, based on understanding. And this is kind of the idea of common law, that the principles build based on their own logic and the system elaborates from within. Instead of leaving the system and trying to build the new one, you instead work within the system to reform and to find the parts of it that are good and promising and encourage and grow those, and to, you know, try to diminish the focus on others. So that's, I don't know if that's a critique of camp crafting as such, probably not, because whatever group you find yourself in, you're always going to want to, you know, grow through adversity, have certain sort of bonding rituals. I guess the one qualification I would put on Samson's framework is, I don't think you can invent religious rituals to give significance to a group. Maybe you can find old rituals that had some symbolic potency and repurpose them. But, you know, if you draw from outside of a framework that you're already a part of, they're going to lack some essential meaning that they had as part of the framework that they were a part of. Every, like, symbolic relics from another culture, if we bring them into the West, maybe they have some sort of exoticism or something. But at the end of the day, rediscovering the own the traditions that you find yourself already a part of, learning about those, I think is probably, for many people, would be a much more fruitful way of camp crafting than to, yeah, try to draw in a bunch of traditions that they're not a part of.
Yeah. It's interesting what you bring up about, I know you gave the example of like exiting your gender, but there's, you know, anything that you exit, what you're doing essentially is you're admitting to yourself that you don't have the power to change within that structure, that you can't be impactful within that institution in order to evolve it.
Yeah.
And if you go through a Tony Robbins seminar, like the first thing that they talk about is that the most powerful force in the world is your brain's desire to stay consistent with the narrative that it's telling itself, that your beliefs build your identity. And if you want to change your identity, then you need to change your beliefs. James Clear has really systematized this in Atomic Habits, which is, in order to change your actions, you need to change your identity. If you want to quit drinking, if you want to quit overeating, if you want to quit doing these things that you know are negative, or if you want to start doing something that you know is positive, you need to identify as that. It's not, I'm going to start running. It's, I am a runner. And tell yourself that. It's not, I am going to try and learn how to play guitar. It's, I'm a guitar player.
Yeah.
And you first have to tell yourself a better story to align with the identity that you want to bring into the world, because the identity is not, it's not static. That identities can change and they can evolve over time. And an institution is just an expression of the identity of the people that come together. And so you do bring up a really good point there, in that you know, it's, it's admitting powerlessness. It's admitting that you don't have control to make a change. And we all have control to make a change. We all have the ability to change at the core level within our own mind, and then to affect people around us. And through that, bring, you know, be the light that you want the world to see.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's very well said. Tribalism. So we've been talking about tribalism as an evolved solution in the next part of the book, or just moving directly on from this. So tribalism evolves as a way to solve this problem of how do we know who to trust? If we can read the symbols of another person, I can say Lucas is somebody from, by the way he dresses, from Northwest Kansas. Look at the boots and everything. I know I can trust him.
This doesn't look San Francisco.
You know, the Livestrong polo is nice, but maybe not Silicon Valley nice. But there's also, in addition to this tribe drive that's an evolved solution, we also are now developing technological solutions to the problem of trust. And now Bitcoin enters the chat.
It's so awesome. It's so great. Like it took 400 pages to get to it.
But it's a culmination, though.
But it's it is the technology. I know you're going to say this better than I am, but it is the life-changing technology that allows us to scale trust beyond the tribe. And it changes everything.
Yeah.
It changes everything about the way that we're going to interact with the world.
Yeah. And he said, you know, it takes 300, 400 pages to get here. It takes, you know what, two and a half hours of conversation for us to get to this point where we can cogently talk about Bitcoin's role as far as a trust facilitator, given our evolved need to know who we can trust. If we don't have all this prehistory, all this discussion, we're talking about the tribe drive, how it evolves as a solution to resolve problems of who to know, who to trust, then you lose an essential aspect of the power of Bitcoin as a technology. And so, I mean, that's why it's really important that I think we read books that don't have Bitcoin on the cover. Even if you're looking to read something about Bitcoin, you're going to need to learn about sociology, anthropology, evolutionary theory, if you really want to understand the system of incentives that is the Bitcoin protocol. So Samson here discusses how Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonymous inventor of Bitcoin, had a solution to the trust paradox, this problem of how do we know who to trust? So Satoshi gave us a way for strangers to interact with strangers and know beyond any doubt that the interaction is trustworthy. With the integration of proof of work into the Bitcoin protocol, he gives us a way to develop a globally shared consensus view that is established without any particular person having to trust any other particular person. So without going into like the nitty gritty of proof of work, all that's involved there, for our purposes here, we can simply observe that Bitcoin, the protocol, allows the creation of a ledger, a way of conducting and recording transactions where zero trust is required of the people participating, who you are transacting with, and you don't have to trust equally anybody to maintain the overall ledger itself. So with this trust technology, with Bitcoin as a trust technology, we have something that scales beyond Dunbar's number. Our limited cognitive channel capacity to process social relations is something that makes Bitcoin very well suited as a technology to allow us to interact with strangers who we can't keep in our head, essentially, as one of the 150 people we're comfortable with. We don't need to personally trust everybody who we contract, who we transact with through the Bitcoin protocol. Because we don't need to trust them, because we don't have to trust them, we don't have to read their tribal symbols and judge to see if they're a threat or a potential ally. We don't need to make sure the person is a member of the same tribe. We don't need to know the color of their skin, the ideological contents of their brain, their faith, any of that. Instead, we can rely on a technology that scales trust without creating an in-group or an out-group and without involving a centralizing tyrant to enforce it. So there's some more there, but I guess I'll pause there because it's quite the pan to Bitcoin to put it at the culmination of our evolutionary history, trying to find a way to solve this problem. Who do we trust?
Yeah. It takes away the need for ideology. This is a callback to the introduction that I gave, which is that in reading this, I had this revelation of, you know, I've been for 4.5 years, I've been thinking of myself like first as a Bitcoiner. And that's why we're reading this book it's not because we're Bitcoiners, but it's because we are approaching the world from a Bitcoin perspective. And in doing so, what we realize is that it's merely the base layer, and there is so much more richness on top of that, with developing a community, with understanding that, you know, my primary identity is no longer — that was the revelation I had at 4 o'clock in the morning when I was finishing the reading like a kid before a test — was that I'm not going to identify as that anymore. I'm not going to let that be my ideology, that my most important identity is as a brother and a friend and as an honor group member to these people around me, because I no longer need to have an ideology in order to signal myself as belonging to an in-group, because there was not a solution for the trust dilemma. And so now I can just accept Bitcoin like I accept gravity. I can accept Bitcoin like I can accept the sun coming up.
Yeah.
And this is just something that I live in, but it doesn't define me. The things that I do define me, the actions that I take, the way that I interact with the people around me, in order to refine my morality, promote those values, and surround myself with other people who do the same, that's so much more important than being a Bitcoiner. I know this podcast, you know, is called Bitcoin Study Sessions, but it can't be the thing that defines us. We can't limit ourselves to being a Bitcoiner. We can't limit ourselves to just reading books that are solely about how Bitcoin changes everything. We are still going to have to be that change. We're still going to have to be the change that we want to see in the world. And it's so impactful to have that realization that I can let go of these ideologies.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And Samsa continues on. He doesn't stop at Bitcoin. So he continues the dialogue in the direction you're going, that Bitcoin changes things. But then what direction is this change going to take us? How further are we going to change society? So Bitcoin introduces this decentralized ledger that we can record transactions of value. There's this then decentralized ethos is a direct check and balance to the developing authoritarian centralizing trajectory we find ourselves on as a way to control all these kind of different groups and tribes. So Samson describes four different pillars of decentralization that we get from jumping off from Bitcoin as a technology: decentralized communication, decentralized law, decentralized production, decentralized finance. And these decentralizing all of these areas permits the possibility of a network state. And here, we've already talked about this, but here in the book is where Samson discusses this type of state, as you've described it in more detail, lying on a continuum of the development of what a state is, from a church state to a nation state to a network state. He describes it as, you know, what it is, an intentional community of people. You gather in the digital realm and then acquire real world property to organize a society around moral innovation. Samson has Balaji's one sentence recapitulation of what the network state is. It has all the different elements that Balaji considers kind of significant or necessary. Generally, as we kind of mentioned, it's a type of society that is also like a subscription service where exit is very important. You can leave and join a different one if the current one does not meet your needs. We already kind of talked about the network state and how it fits in. Like, is there anything to add to that?
One of the things that of those four pillars that I find really interesting, and why I know this would be a very contrarian thing to say, but why I would bet against Amazon, is decentralized production. Because what we have right now are products. I think it's 55% of all the things Americans buy come from Amazon, or 45 or something like that. Literally everybody else, Walmart, Target, everybody else, they fight over the remaining, say, half. But the model is centralization. Here's the production. It's going to a distribution facility, and then it's getting on a plane or a truck, and then it's getting to you. And if you break down the cost structure of what you end up paying a lot of what you pay is delivery and transportation cost and just simply the energy to get it there. And so with 3D printing, where you have the ability to have a factory where you have, in one side, we're putting in goods, we're putting in raw materials, and in the other side, out comes finished goods. And we can do that in Osborne, Kansas, and we can do that in Manitoba, and we can do that in Chile. Then I think you see that the logistical advantage that Amazon holds over competitors that evolved as when they took that to scale, like that's what they beat people on, is we're going to get it to you fast, and we're going to get it to you with a wide variety of selection. Like that's when Jeff Bezos talks about, people always make the mistake of looking into the future and saying what's going to be different. And he says, you know, what you should do is look into the future and say what's going to be the same.
Yeah.
And what's going to be the same is that people are going to want a wide variety. They're going to want it quick and they're going to want it cheap. And if we can decentralize production such that there is in every town, every village, every hamlet, they have their own little production facilities that makes their shoes, makes their rugs, makes their furniture, et cetera, et cetera. Then we have solved all of those problems at a local level.
Yeah.
So I find that one to be like a really fascinating potential consequence of technology, which is that the decentralized everything. It's not, hey, we're going to have decentralized money, but Amazon's going to rule the world. I actually think that it's going to go the other way.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll be Amazon that puts them all there, that puts all these little ones there. But in the end, I think it's still going to be more advantageous for a community to individually purchase that, run it. And that removes the added layer of the profit incentive of Amazon. You still have to maintain the equipment and stuff, but we're just going along this path of removing middlemen. We're taking middlemen out of banking. We're taking middlemen out of law. We're taking them out of healthcare. And so I have no reason to believe that it wouldn't continue with production.
And maybe it continues further. Decentralizing technologies may be even more disruptive than we can imagine. Samson continues on to discuss something we've discussed, Jason Lowry's software thesis. We have six or so podcasts like going in depth into that. Samson noted on Twitter that he had initially a lot more space devoted to Lowry embology. He's got like now like half a page on Lowry here. I could just read the entirety, but I'll give kind of a summary of Samson's summary of software, which is useful, I think, because software is an often misunderstood thesis. I don't know that I even fully understand it perfectly. If you look at the Twitter takes on it, there's a lot of hate towards it, but it's often by people who, you know, haven't done the time to really consider what it means. And so Samson, it looks like he did do the time. And so here's kind of my summary of Samson's summary. Generally, ownership of a resource is determined by who projects the most power over it. You own something if you can project power to forcibly prevent others from taking it from you. War is the current power projection protocol that determines ownership of societal resources. We verify who owns something according to who is able to project the most military power to control it, control access to it, control who has it. But war is ineffective against data secured by the Bitcoin protocol. No amount of tanks or drones or military violence of any sort can breach the protocol and take the resource that it secures. We can now therefore determine the owner of a resource in a way that doesn't require the projection of kinetic military power. Samson concludes in one sentence, Bitcoin is the first property in human history that you cannot take with violence. So again, that's a huge condensation of a very complex thesis. But do you feel, I mean, that the software thesis does fit into this accounting of our tribal nature in the practice of making tribes?
Yeah. I mean, we're going to look back on Satoshi Nakamoto as maybe the Wright brothers who invented flight. And we're going to look back on Jason Lowry as the modern day Billy Mitchell, who recognized the importance. Satoshi obviously recognized the importance, but Jason takes it to another level that I don't think Satoshi even envisioned, which is that to understand war, you have to understand resources. And he does it in software from a biological level, from single-celled organisms all the way up to the most complex individuals, humans, that war is controlling access to and denying access from resources. And the way that it's a competition, and the winner of the competition gets the resources, and then they have to continue competing at all times in order to control access to and deny access from those resources. And the place that we end up going is that we find ourselves realizing that on the outside, war looks like an ideological battle. You know, capitalist countries don't really go to war against other capitalist countries. Communist countries don't really go to war with other communist countries. It's typically a battle of ideology. But if you extract out and you understand what Samson introduced before, which is the idea of the in-group, and that what we're doing is we're simply directing our energy to the benefit of our in-group, and then recognizing that doing so makes our in-group stronger, even though it comes at the expense of the out-group. That's what war is. I'm trying to make my in-group stronger, and I'm going a little over the edge in that I am swinging my fist where it connects with your nose, and I am causing harm to the out-group. But because I prefer my in-group to my out-group, then I have no moral problem doing that. And that's all of these wars that we've been involved in the United States for the last 80 years, they're all moral wars. They're all, this is a battle of values. This
purportedly
is
purportedly moral wars.
Yeah, exactly. Sold as morality. Yeah. Yeah. Where he even talks about that. There's somebody that was fighting in, I think, the Iraq war, and, you know, talked to some people from the other side and was like, I was shocked to find out that they thought of themselves as the Rebel Alliance in Star Wars, and we were we're the Death Star. When over here we think of the exact opposite. We're freeing these people, we're giving them democracy at the point of a gun. Just the importance of not having to use physical violence and take lives in order to preference your in-group is elevating to all of humanity. And it gives another just giant feather in the cap of hope.
Yeah. And Samson, maybe he would have elaborated more had he dedicated the space to it, had his editor not cruelly forced him. I know. Forced him to remove that portion. He might have gone on to Lowry discussing how Bitcoin itself is power projection and is going to continue the competition. We all have, a tribal drive in a sense to compete against the outgroup. We can now do so peacefully by participating in a hashing power competition through Bitcoin miners, out of the loop warfare in which machines do all the fighting by participating in the Bitcoin protocol.
As envisioned by Nikola Tesla.
That's right.
I can't let that opportunity pass, that, Bitcoin is not something that we've been working towards this for over a century, or it's been the path that we've been on for over a century. And as Lynn Alden notes in Broken Money, that the need for Bitcoin, the need for this, has been around since, I think it was like 1856, which was the invention of the telegraph.
Yeah.
I probably got that date wrong, but.
No. Yeah, there's a lot of different narratives at which you can arrive at Bitcoin as the culmination of that narrative. The evolutionary narrative here is a new one and a great one to add to that list. Lynn Alden, as you said, gave us a technological narrative of needing something to transport value because gold cannot be moved through the telegraph. So we needed something like Bitcoin so that settlement and transaction speeds could match. So although Samson does laud the role that Bitcoin can play here, he does even talk about Jason Lowry's software thesis, which can sound utopic to a certain degree. But he does know and continue on to discuss, I mean, Bitcoin doesn't truly eradicate tribalism as such. The tribe drive is who we are. It's part of us. It's a genetic thing. At most, of course, it's a set of incentives that plays well with who we are as tribal creatures. The true solution, in Samson's estimation, comes when we can bootstrap the tribe drive itself to eradicate the malevolent forms of tribalism and help humanity enter a new era. So we have to be the surgeon doing surgery on ourselves to use this tribe drive to better ourselves, to redirect it to useful ends, so to speak. So to restate the problem that we're gonna use tribalism to solve, ideology has been at the center of a lot of 21st century violence. Ideology is a form of tribalism, is an expression of the tribal drive, of the need to tribally signal, to see who to trust. Ideology is a set of symbols adhered to as a way to signal trustworthiness to other adherents of the ideology. Ideologies aren't usually a set of arguments we accept. They are just a set of symbols we buy into so we can determine who to trust. Ideologies have led to a lot of impaired thinking and bad ideas, in Samson's estimation. Religious ideologies have given us terror bombings. Racial ideologies led to discrimination and racism. Political ideologies, dissension, cancel culture, political violence. Ideologies have this effect of compromising our cognitive immune system, our ability. A bad idea is a mind virus. It travels mind to mind, like viruses travel body to body. Ideologies compromise, they weaken the immune system we have to bad ideas. Samson gives this framework, drawing on Andy Norman's work to discuss cognitive immunology. Ideologies do this by inducing in us a state of what Samson calls willful unreason, where we refuse to consider. So willful unreason, when you're under an ideological thrall, is the refusal to consider evidence and instead to defend our ideological group identity at all costs. Samson calls this the tribe virus, when willful unreason is attached to an identity that we will not give up. In those cases, the tribe trumps truth because the tribe is what ensures our survival. There's evolutionary reasoning behind this. There's a reason why we adhere to ideologies, even when the evidence tells us that our ideology is bunk, because they help us survive. Samson believes then that the solution is for all of us to join or subscribe to a meta-tribal identity, an identity that sits on top of all of our other identities. It's the top of the identity stack, so to speak. The metatribal identity has only one principle. It is the meta belief, a belief about beliefs, the meta belief that beliefs should change in response to evidence. That is the metatribal identity is designed to surgically remove the willful unreason portion of all the ideologies we might adhere to. So in this view, you can still adhere to whatever other ideology, you can still be a progressive, a Christian, whatever, but you have to subject all of them to the meta belief, the overriding commitment that you will be willing to change your commitments to those other ideologies in response to the evidence. So in this view, if you have the meta tribal identity of revising your views based on evidence, if you believe that Donald Trump is an evil authoritarian who's trying to become king, you can still believe that, but you have to be open to evidence that would disprove that, and then to actually change your mind if you do receive such evidence. The overall idea of the meta tribe is to create a tribe that is simply called Team Human. So one final and universal tribe to rule them all, And to restate what that entails, Samson gives us the creed of Team Human, the Metatribe. This is the belief that everybody's a member of Team Human, the Metatribe would have to have. That is, I am a member of Team Human. Our creed is that beliefs can change in light of evidence. We are a community of inquiry where beliefs are deemed reasonable if they can withstand reasonable challenges to their veracity. We are the Metatribe. My question to you then, Lucas, is do you find that, I guess, viable, practical, realistic, beautiful, whatever? Do you think that you are a member of Team Human and do you have this metatribal belief?
Yeah, I think we all want to, we all aspire to be the person who sees the world as it is, unaffected by your bias. And this is the value of steel manning the other side's position, where you make the case for the side that you are opposed to from their side using their best argument in a way that they would not object to. And what this makes me think of is just you sit next to somebody who's a rabid fan of a football team, and there's a penalty on their team. And of course, they think that it's spurious and they think that it's wrong. And then the exact same thing happens for the other team. And of course, it's deserved. I'm a Kansas City Royals baseball fan. And in 1985, they won the World Series, but they won the World Series on a blown call at first base that, when you review the tape, the guy was clearly out by like 6 to 8 feet.
Ooh.
Like, no, it's not, it is not justifiable at all.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as a Royals fan, I'm glad that I was not only alive, but able to participate in 2015 when they won their technically second World Series. But to me, it was the first one because I saw that video and I looked at that and I go, there is no way that I can justify supporting the end result of them becoming the champions when that was the call that gave them the opportunity to win. Without that, then they lose. And so we all want to aspire to be that person that is comfortable in the face of opposition, and that's able to face their own bias. And he, Samson, does a good job of giving us these examples where, you know, if you, in the scenario that Donald Trump is accused of tax evasion and there's, you know, a misdemeanor is elevated to 30 some felonies because it's past the statute of limitations. Is that deserved? And, oh, you know, on one side, of course that is, you know, this is a horrible person who's doing horrible things. And then, okay, well, what if it's Joe Biden or what if it's Barack Obama or, you know, Donald Trump is a racist, or not, you know, he's a racist, or he's a rapist. You know, that's horrible things to, you know, it's just a terrible person. Well, okay, but, you know, Bill Clinton settled like a half a dozen rape cases. Like, is that something that you also feel the same amount of fervent emotionality about, or that you also see as just as legitimate? The benefit of steel manning is just that you make yourself more comfortable in the beliefs that you have because you've put them to the ultimate test of fighting the war for the other side with the best weapons that are available.
Yeah, he calls that the moral mirror test. When you imagine one figure of the opposing tribe doing something and then imagine a member of the same, of your tribe doing the same thing, do you have the same emotional interior reaction to that? And in that way, you can evaluate your tribal identity. But I want to get you on record with the response to this question. Are you a member of Team Human, the Metatribe? Do you think that adhering to a meta belief that all beliefs should be revisable based on openness to the evidence, that should sit atop the identity stack, so to speak, and that is a commitment that you think you for yourself is valuable, or should commit to that, and other people should as well?
It's tough because the example he gives in the book is, you know, a debate between an atheist and a believer in Christ, and ask the atheist what it would take in order to change his opinion. And he says, evidence. And you ask the believer what it would take to change his opinion. And he says, nothing. And Samson calls that out as, you know, this is the thing that causes our problems, you know. Yet there, to me, is something so beautiful about faith. There is something beautiful about not needing evidence. It's hope, and hope is what moves us forward. Hope is what gives us an ability to better the world and think that there's a reason to get up in the morning and not be in constant existential dread. So I'm glad that you're putting me to the fire on that, because I do really struggle with that one, because I, above all else, what I want, I think, is the ability to believe in something without requiring evidence. And just because I think it's beautiful, I think it's romantic, and I think it's a wonderful position to be in. So I don't know if I could come around to that, just because I think that it is what drives us as humanity, is that we do have hope, that we do have faith, and that our reach does exceed our grasp. What's a heaven for without that? And so, yeah, I don't know. I think I may fail that more, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Moral mirror or whatever.
No, that's the meta belief for the meta tribe of team humanity, that commitment. I disagree with Samson on this. I don't think he has that dialogue you mentioned between Bill Nye and Ken Ham. Nye says, I'll change my mind based on the evidence. Ham says, I'm a Christian. Nothing will convince that the word of God is not true. Nye's response, I find to be glib, trivial, and wrong. Like, who decides what evidence is?
Yeah.
Evidence of what? Why does evidence work? Does evidence itself presuppose a law-like, observable, objective reality that one can only accept based on faith? I mean, that's kind of the natural law theory. Like, this idea that you can be a scientist without, and that can supplement, or supplant your whole substantive view of reality, I just find that to be very, very wrong. Neil deGrasse Tyson had this idea at one point that we could have a virtual country called Rationalia, where all policy was decided on the weight of the evidence. And it's just like, that's like, evidence does not work in that way. And there's all sorts of metaphysical arguments about, like, what is this evidence? What's going to be sufficient evidence? Who decides what the evidence is? Like, evidence of what? Does evidence presuppose that there's a non-material truth or no truth beyond, like you said, that our reach can never exceed our grasp or whatever, that there's no truth beyond human ken? Can we, I mean, I just find that such a blinkered and small conception of what the human experience is, to say that evidence will rule over everything. I certainly have commitments that I would say no evidence could convince me, because what I mean as a shorthand is no evidence I could receive through the modality of my five senses could convince me that this truth that I perceived in a different way is not true. In William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience, he talks about how the mystic who has had an encounter with God is, in some sense, you can't argue with them because they had an encounter. They had an experience. They received evidence. The religious person who says, I'm a Christian, they have received evidence. They feel God's presence. And so, like, Ham wasn't saying, when he says nothing will convince that the word of God is not true, what he means is, I've had a mystical perception of a truth that is not going to be disproved by you showing me how, you know, humans evolve from apes. There's different types of evidence. And like, that perception of a spiritual reality sits atop the stack for me. And so, like, there's a sign from a Neutral Milk Hotel song, like, how strange it is to be anything at all. And that's like a truth that sits atop my stack, that like, there's an utter strangeness to every moment of existence. Just to be here now is so utterly strange. And like, that repels any sort of evidence to disconfirm that there's something like distinct about this. And so, like, I don't agree with the evidence or science, I guess.
Love is the answer, and love requires faith beyond what the evidence shows, because to love someone is to disregard that one day, and as long as we're quoting from songs, Jason Isbell has a song called If We Were Vampires, and in it he talks about, you know, one day one of us is going to be alone. And, you know, that's that realization that this isn't going to, I'm entering this knowing that it's going to end. I'm entering this knowing that you're not perfect, that you're going to fail me, I'm going to fail you, yet I'm going to move into that direction of love because of the faith that I have that things will become better because I'm participating in this. I just quoted this on X this morning, which is, this is Derek Sivers wrote a book called Useful But Not True, but there are also things that are true but not useful. Nice. And while it may be true that there is no evidence for God, or there is no evidence for the perfect relationship, because the perfect relationship doesn't exist, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't pursue it. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't move into that direction, because it does. It comes back down to, you know, am I team human? I'm team human because I believe in the power of love, and that is faith. And it does not require evidence, and it does not care about it.
Yeah.
I don't need evidence of love to know that it exists, and to experience it is ineffable. It is not able to be shared. You know, this is why I think it's like 99% or 97% of all songs are written about love. We're just trying to explain this thing that we can't explain, and we're going to keep doing it forever and ever and ever.
The scientist,
we're never going to get
there. The scientist glibly responds, well, it's just a set of hormones, Lucas.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and that's the naivete and the ignorance that is so obvious when you hear someone talk about psychedelics, who's never done psychedelics, who's never had that out-of-body experience that you experience during meditation or breath work, or even during like incredibly vigorous exercise, when you are leaving this thinking part of yourself and you're just being. I've heard people, I won't say who, because hopefully we'll get them on the podcast sometime, but I've heard people dismiss psychedelics. And as someone who's done, it's just, you, like what you said about God, is that you don't, it's very obvious when you haven't felt that experience because of the way people talk about it. And if you hear somebody talk about psychedelics or, you know, having an out of body experience, however you access that, to hear someone who's ignorant of that talk about it and try to justify a position on it is, it just sounds silly.
Yeah.
And you're like, another, you know, is there any way to learn from what you've been told, or do you have to really hold the experience? And you do, you have to hold the experience in order to understand what it means to be loved, what it means to feel God,
yeah,
what it means to truly be a part of team human.
Yep. Yeah. And I will say that Samson, he does endorse entheogens in this book, not endorse in the sense that you should do them, but he notes that as a camp crafting experience, entheogens, hallucinogens, yep, certain types of compounds that stimulate certain sorts of experiences can be useful maybe as adverse experiences or team building, or to give you, your group, a sense of identity and purpose. I see what he's doing here. Like, you know, he's identified what is bad about many ideologies. They induce a sense of willful unreason that's has caused a lot of harm, a lot of pain, you know, a lot of death. There's been a lot of blood flowing in rivers for this very reason, that we're willful we have willful unreason and won't revise our opinions about certain things. But I just don't think that this idea of team human is a useful one, that we can have a commitment to revise everything based on the weight of the evidence, because even that conception of the evidence, it presupposes like an Enlightenment tradition that people would say comes from the Judeo-Christian, like this time in European history where a specific conception of truth arose that has an antecedent tradition that brings us to that point. And you can't just divorce it from that thing. I think that like truth always occurs within a specific tradition. Another Alistair MacIntyre reference, even just the title of this book, Who's Justice, Which Rationality? You can't just appeal to rationality or evidence. Rationality and evidence only make sense within a specific tradition that defines like what, you know, he endorses the concentric circle conception of morality. That's based on utilitarian moral reasoning. He talks about Peter Singer in here. I just disagree with utilitarianism as such for reasons that, I mean, like we could get into as far as Alistair MacIntyre and his description of virtue ethics stemming from Aristotle. And so I don't find the concentric circle, you know, to be persuasive. I think that it's trying to graft on a philosophical tradition that one doesn't need to have to recognize the evils of tribalism. And again, like this idea that evidence will save us. Nothing is going to save us from who we are. It's going to be an irrational enterprise we all embark on together to save ourselves.
Yeah. And arguing over truth is just tilting at windmills. We talked about this with Jason Lowry's software thesis and the understanding of what science is. And I had looked this quote up yesterday. I'm going to butcher it. It's from Richard Feynman. But science is, the process of believing in the ignorance of experts or something like that. And with Jason Lowry's software thesis, when he does this grounded theory methodology, as opposed to the hypothesis approach, you know, the hypothesis approach gives us two things. There is no truth. There is no truth. We either prove something to be false under certain conditions, or we prove it to not yet be false. And we never introduce the idea of truth because we can't say with certainty that something is a truth. And with the grounded theory methodology, which Lowry does, and I would say that Sampson absolutely has used that type of approach in our tribal future, is that you come at it from different angles and from every attack surface that you can find. And in doing so, you don't find a truth, but you get further away from the false and hopefully closer to the direction of truth. We just need to move beyond and dismiss this idea that we're fighting over what's true and what's not, because there is, like, we have to accept that there is no truth, that we are just existing and we have things that we know that are false, and we have things that we know not yet to be false. But as we enter this era of quantum, you know, I'm sitting here and you're sitting there, but not in the quantum world. You know, everything is everywhere all at once. Everything is affecting everything all at once. And that totally breaks our ability to understand the world as we see it now. But that is not false. And so it may not be true, but it's certainly not false that this particle here affects this particle here at the other end of the universe instantaneously. And we know that to be not false. And so divorcing ourselves from the need to wrap ourselves in a blanket of truth, is paramount in moving forward and being able to understand more about the world around us. And there's beauty in that understanding. And that's another Feynman quote, which was, "Poets say science takes away from the beauty of the stars, mere globes of gas atoms. But nothing is mere. I too can see the stars as masses of gas, but they are mysterious masses of twinkling lights, and their motions are determined by laws which we didn't invent but discovered. And we find that, you know, the more that you understand something, the more beautiful it is. The deeper you get into the law, the more beautiful law is. The more I get into music, the more beautiful music is. So we just move closer and closer to truth, but we need to accept that it's not a place, it's a journey. And we're on that journey together.
Wow. From quantum theory to the nature of truth as a journey. I don't know that I my head's not big enough to fit these thoughts. So I'm just a mere Bitcoiner. That's all I do. I just stack my coins, man. Stack my sats. So I evolved just for that reason. I out of my depth, brother. So
is that you tapping out?
It's like I tapped out long ago, man. I couldn't. No, this is a fascinating book. I'm not saying I'm tapping out. I'm just saying it's gone beyond my grasp to comprehend truth here. And I think it's a great book, I guess. Yeah. I don't know how to recap the conversation because it's been sprawling and a lot of fun. I disagree with parts of the book, obviously. I agree with a lot of it. And whether I disagree or agree, it's very useful. If you want to craft a camp, very good kind of contours for how to do that, outlines, parameters. Very interesting science as far as like why we're tribal creatures, and highly recommended for Bitcoiners exactly because you're only going to hit Bitcoin, you know, 360 pages in.
Yeah. You know, as we leave, there's one thing that we didn't talk about, which is not the overarching thesis or anything, but it's what I want to leave people with, which is, the importance of having a goal. Samson notes, you know, every study that has ever been conducted on goals versus not having goals is if you state a goal, then you're more likely to achieve something. You know, it may not be the goal that you state, but at least you have given yourself a target. You know, as Jordan Peterson would say, you know, you've given yourself something to aim at, you know, a peak to ascend. And as you move in the direction of that goal, you start to marshal your resources more efficiently and direct them into the purpose that you're trying to accomplish. And it's not achieving the goal that is important. It's moving closer to it. It's not ascending the mountain and being on the plateau. It's this step and this step and this step. It's not the mountain. It's just another step. And so if you've made it this deep into the conversation and you're looking for something that is a takeaway, just one thing to walk away from this, set a goal. Set a goal and identify the steps that it takes you to reach that goal, and give yourself something that moves you in that direction. Start to lay that groundwork. You know, that was, you know, we first started having these conversations and we didn't have a goal. We just had it was a goal. It was, hey, we're going to put these up. You know, that's a goal. Like a goal is there. And then you can move to a different goal. And every time you climb a mountain, you can just climb another mountain. And every time you reach something and accomplish something, you can just go higher. And so, yeah, that's what I would say is set a goal and find yourself in a better position today than you were yesterday.
Right on. Practical goal. Buy Samson's book, read it, and let us know your thoughts. But yeah, appreciate that, Lucas.
All right. Thank you.